Hello and welcome to the Design Break Podcast, a new podcasting experience designed to help you break into the creative world and grow your career. I'm your host, Rocky Rourke, founder and design director of Blue Cyclops Design Company, and I'm here to help you. So let's get started. Hello, podcast family. Welcome to a brand new episode of Design Break Podcast. I'm your host, Rocky Rourke, and I've got Tom Froese. By the way, I said that right?
You did, yeah.
I've got Tom Froese with me, an award-winning illustrator and designer based out of Canada. He has clients including Airbnb, Yahoo, The Wall Street Journal, and many others, and has been featured multiple times in Communication Arts magazine. Thanks for coming on, Tom. How are you doing today?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So for everybody who might not know who you are, why don't you talk a little bit more about yourself? I talked a little bit about you, but it'd be great to hear it from your words.
Sure. Well, thanks for the very flattering introduction on your side. I'll give you my kind of elevator pitch. I'm an illustrator in Vancouver, British Columbia. I connect people to brands through lively, buoyant illustration. I'm also a top teacher on Skillshare, where I have a growing selection of illustration-related classes that really are aimed to empower new and kind of any illustrator who's interested in just kind of growing and kind of peeling back the curtain a little bit more and becoming more pro. I'm also a part-time YouTuber, and I just aim to bring insights and inspiration to illustrators. And on top of all that, I'm a dad of two beautiful spunky girls, and lately a late blooming runner. So that's very everything. Nice. Thought I'd cover.
That's everything. I miss before when I was a lot skinnier. I used to run a lot. I think 15 races in 1 year.
Oh wow.
Yeah, it was right after I had lost a bunch of weight, and I was like doing good, and I like told myself, okay, every month I'm going to run a race. Ended up running more, got hurt, then ran a 10-mile race. It was crazy.
Huh. Yeah, I don't think I've even done 4 races yet, so.
They're a lot of fun. I feel like when you're out running, and you're running, you know, with a bunch of people in like one of these 5Ks or 10Ks or whatever it is, it feels so uplifting
totally.
And empowering. And I was even running these when I was still, still a big guy. And I would love seeing these like, you know, skinny girls or these skinny guys try and like run past me. And then I would catch up and pass them. And they were like, how is he passing us?
Yeah, that's a pretty good feeling.
Yeah. So you originally didn't even go to school for design, right? You trained as more of like a computer engineer.
That's right, yeah.
Like what ultimately caused you to make that transition from computer engineering to design and illustration?
Do you want the long story or the short story?
Let's go with short. Let's go with short.
The short? Okay. The very short story is I ended up in a community college type computer engineering program. Mm-hmm. But I never really quite felt it was for me. And somehow I felt the need to stay in it the whole way. But meanwhile, on the side, I discovered graphic and industrial design. And I pursued that on the side while I finished my diploma program. So after I graduated, I got a job. And then after a couple of years, I finally kind of developed the courage. I had the sense that like now is the time to do what I've been dreaming for the past 5 years. And I went to art school.
Nice. And so it was in art school that you were focusing more on design, but you ended up finding a love in illustration, correct?
That's right. Yeah. So hadn't ever considered illustration as what I wanted to do. It just I didn't see that. It wasn't on my radar, but I loved design. I loved grids and systems and typography. I loved learning about the history of art and design and even industrial design, product design, all that kind of stuff. Really ate that up, especially from the kind of user-centered kind of thing and the problem-solving aspect. So that's what I went to school for. But the school I went to is called NASCAD. It's called Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. And it's just such a small school and very interdisciplinary. So a lot of schools will kind of pigeonhole you, get you in advertising or, you know, one of these very specific disciplines. For me, I was like, while I was learning typography and stuff like that, I was also learning book arts and painting and printmaking and stuff like that. So there's just that exposure. And long story short, I ended up having a type class with some instructors who were actively designers and illustrators. They had a small studio in Halifax, but they were doing work for big companies like Urban Outfitters, and they were publishing books. They were doing illustration for New York Times and stuff like that. And so when I was interning for them, I really just like design and illustration were just kind of one and the same thing. You just did it all. And that's really where I kind of cut, how I cut my teeth. And the illustration side is just part of being a designer. And so I took that with me into my jobs out of school. And then eventually I just found that longing to just do illustration. It just felt more me. I like the pacing of it. I like the way the projects are shorter typically, and the expressiveness, the more personal aspect of illustration felt more me. So I ended up just kind of gradually discovering that about myself, and then looking for the clues to how to do it, finding them, and then doing it.
Yeah, I love that. I know that I found, like, when I was doing research and digging up information on you, I know that sounds like a stalker and everything. I apologize. But I noticed when I was, like, looking at your background, looking at some of the other interviews you've done, that you actually had something interesting. And I could be wrong in this assumption, so you can completely correct me. But it seems like you actually transitioned from freelance to then working at, you know, studios, agencies, and then transitioning back to freelance, that's an interesting, you know, journey. And can you talk a little bit about that? Like going from freelance to job to freelance?
Yeah, sure. Maybe I'll just start like out of art school, design school or whatever. I was lucky enough to land a job in Vancouver as an art director for kind of a boutique design studio. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like an amazing experience. I learned so much, but I told myself no matter what, no matter how good a job is, I'm not going to stay there longer than 2 years. Mm-hmm. Because I feel, and this is possibly controversial to say out loud, but I feel that people who get too comfortable become complacent, and they stop being as creative as they could be. And I didn't 100%
agree.
I didn't want that for myself. I know that for me to be motivated and stay on my feet and keep fire in my belly, I needed to stay somewhere long enough to learn and grow and contribute, but move on once that cycle is complete. And so I quit after 2 years of my first job, and it was such a intensive experience, that first job, that I thought maybe I'll just, and it was summer when I quit, so I thought maybe I'll just try freelancing, see how that goes. And it went pretty badly. I had a few jobs here and there, but I ended up over the whole summer making like $1,000 or something. It was not sustainable.
Yeah. Were you freelancing at the same time when you were working at the agency, or you weren't?
No. I had a couple jobs. We had a non-compete kind of thing at the job I was working at. So it was hard. I was more or less forbidden from taking on any other work, because it would kind of be a conflict of interest, I guess. Mm-hmm. And some companies just aren't okay with that. So anyway, I had a couple editorial assignments that I had done along the way. I had made a lot of contacts, so I felt confident that I could, maybe it would work. It was a shot in the dark. I was able to do it because my wife had a really good job and she was bringing home the bacon for the summer. So I kind of, you know, tried my thing, and then I was like, no, I gotta get back to work. This isn't good. My wife is pregnant at the time too, so I had to get a job. I couldn't lay that freelance out anymore. So that was the first freelancing stint for about a summer, and then I ended up getting a job as a designer at a very nearby studio to where we lived. And long story short, I was not a good fit there. I did not feel good there. It brought the worst out in me. So I quit. And then I just did contract work. So I would work for Vancouver agencies, big and small, and just kind of pick up jobs here and there. And it was enough. It was good. I enjoyed that. And then eventually I ended up landing a job as full-time as a design director at an ad agency. And again, after a few months working there, I kept getting in trouble. not because I was doing anything bad or wrong. It was just the way I my vision in my and what I thought I was able to do in that position were not always aligning with what my coworkers and my creative director, what they thought I should be doing. Mm-hmm. It was just, I was just like, I think if I'm going to last in this industry, this creative industry, I'm going to need to do it on my own somehow or another. I've got what it takes, and I need to just do it on my own because I have such a strong opinion and vision mm-hmm. for how I think things should work, you know, how to interact with clients, what my role is, what their role is, what we are allowed to do within a project. So I just was able to, at that point, I had enough work going that I could make that jump again. And so mm-hmm. my second time going fully freelance was after that job. And I started really as a designer. And then over time, if you've read some of my interviews, I just say that I kind of biased my portfolio more toward illustration until I kind of engineered that scenario until I was actually getting more and more of that illustration work.
And so you say that you had some projects going. So you were freelancing this time around before you made that jump. Do you feel like that could have been like what helped push you more towards success the second time around for going freelance?
100%. I mean, that was the momentum I needed. And so that time it didn't feel like a huge leap. I actually kind of had this, you know, I talk about the myth of the leap or the big jump into freelance. If you do that, my first scenario will happen to you. My first time freelancing, if you don't have a plan, you're not likely to, and you don't have that momentum, you're not likely to succeed right away. You need some kind of safety net if you're going to try it that way. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was like, I actually have like a few people who are coming to me steadily on the side for work. And those clients kind of got built up while I was doing my sort of contract work. And I was able to pick up those other jobs on the side anyway. So that momentum had already started. The train had already left the station. And when I quit my design director job, I just jumped on that already moving train. And it was going. Yeah.
Yeah. When I've been fired from both my jobs outside of college. And the first job, after I was fired, I wanted to actually go full-time freelance. The instant problem I found was I didn't freelance the entire time I was there. So I see a pattern that's very similar to yours. And it caused me to, when I got my next job, okay, I have to freelance. Mm-hmm. And that set me up for success. So I actually love that parallel between your journey and mine. And I think that it's a really interesting thing for people to hear. If they're thinking about going up and doing freelance or wanting to make that leap and working for themselves, they need to, you know, realize and they need to make a plan. I love the fact that you said, like, have a strategy for it versus just, like, jumping out into the wolves, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I really hope people don't do that and expect a lot to come of it because, mm-hmm. you know, it works for some people, but I think if you expect that, you're going to just be really discouraged. Mm-hmm. And I think it'll hurt more than if you maybe had this more strategic approach. But it's also okay if you take that first time, whether you have a strategy or not, and it fails, you're going to learn something from it.
Exactly.
But it's about iteration. It's about everything you do will benefit you if you allow yourself to learn from it and not be discouraged from it. It's like mm-hmm. My mentality has always been, no matter what, if I'm trying to do something that I want and need to do, mm-hmm. whether I fail or not, I'm moving forward, right? 'Cause
No, you're making sense. No, you're making total sense. It's like you always hear whenever, you know, I'm a big, you know, self-help, you know, advice book reader and everything like that. And the one thing that they always say is that, you know, if you fail, don't just dwell on it. Don't just like let it take you over, consume you, you know, use it as a learning experience. And if you fail, then those are just multiple learning experiences along the way.
Exactly. You know?
So exactly. Totally makes sense. One thing that, you know, I consider myself, you know, an illustrator and branding designer. Those are my two traits. I've heard multiple people, a lot of people mention the term commercial artist. And I know that's something that you like to refer to yourself as. I was wondering if you could like explain what a commercial artist is and mm-hmm. why you find that title fits you so well.
Yeah, I think I really had espoused that term to mm-hmm. describe myself a few years ago. Today, I just use Illustrator a lot more. But what I like about commercial artist is that it's the most straightforward and honest description for what I do. There's no reason for me to make art in any serious capacity except to be paid. And if I were left to my own devices and I could make anything I wanted and time and money were an object, I wouldn't make anything. So my artwork has no purpose, and I'm being a little bit facetious here, or whatever, yeah. But my artwork has no purpose outside the commercial context in which they were developed. Mm-hmm. And so that's one reason, for instance, why I don't sell a lot of prints, because mm-hmm. I can't imagine why someone would want to hang an illustration I made for this very specific context and this client in this moment in time on their wall. It just, like, unless I designed a thing to be on a wall, mm-hmm. like, then sure. And I've made a few prints, but yeah, to me, commercial artist just really honestly describes what's happening here. I'm making art for paying clients for commerce. So
yeah, I think I definitely agree with you. And I, for a while I almost considered using that same title, but I also thought about the fact that I am a designer too, right? If I was just focusing on illustration, I would probably use the term commercial artist because I think it does work for mm-hmm. that. But I will say that, you know, I think, and you probably still do this and everything. I think it's also good for us to focus our creativity in other areas besides just like making money. Money is good, mm-hmm. but we also create things for, you know, ourselves to expound our creativity, build our skills. Like, for instance, and I'm going to talk about this a little bit later, I'm taking your Skillshare course on Inky Maps, nice. Which, by the way, I love that. And I love the way that you just like go through and you're like, okay, figure out, you know, these certain points. There's five main, you know, points to a map and everything. I love that. And I think that you also create things, and you might not even be cognizant of it, but like your Skillshare courses. Yeah, you're creating those for money, but you're also creating them to share knowledge and to better other people's lives and stuff like that. And I think when you do make stuff, prints to sell, or if you ever do pro bono work for like events or organizations that you're, you know, doing, you're doing those things for no pay too. And I know that I'm probably blowing this out of proportions or anything like that, but I just want you to know that what you create is so spectacular. I love what you create. And trust me, when I look at your Instagram and I see all the illustrations you create, I would love to have most of them on my wall as prints. Don't like discount yourself or anything like that. You are a spectacular illustrator.
Oh, I really appreciate that. Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully what I'm saying isn't self-deprecating as much as it is sort of just calling what I do what it is. I don't really relate to the pure art world very much. Mm-hmm. And I don't think a lot of us designers and illustrators really do. I think we all sort of like the idea, and we're very comfortable with the idea of making objects that people use and, mm-hmm. and things that have a practical function, and thinking about making work that expresses other people's ideas, not just our own. And I just feel like for me, that's really important. And even when you're doing things like making work for self-development or maybe for pro bono, you're still it's all still within the context of an industry. It's right. You're like with my teaching, I'm empowering other people so that they can make money with what they mm-hmm. do. I know that a huge part of my student body or whatever also is just happy to develop this on their own and have fun. And I very much like to gear my classes toward that person because I don't want the requirement or the pressure to make money doing these things. I don't want that to get in the way. I want people just to see how fun it is to do what I do, to do what we do. And so there is that, but it's all in the context of art that is reproducible. That is, you know, it's all in the tradition of what the old school people would have called commercial art. So, and it is different than design, because design is, there's an art layer to it, and it depends on what kind of designer or design studio you are, what philosophy, what tradition you follow. That art part is purposely de-emphasized. It's more about solving problems and
You know, this actually prompts a question that I constantly see, or I've heard over the years, and it's something that everybody has their own opinion about. Everybody either agrees with it, disagrees with it, or is biased to it. But I'm curious what you think about the idea that design and art either can either coexist together, or that they are one and the same. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a very, I feel like it's a hard question to answer. I can maybe get at it through a back door, which is possibly a tangent. But I'm really interested in this idea that art is actually not a noun or a thing. It's the it's the idea of things that come together for a purpose. There's this guy on YouTube I like to watch. His name's Jonathan Peugeot. And he talks a lot about symbolism, and he likes to break down movies and kind of talk about what's happening on the symbolic level and stuff. And I find that fascinating. But he's also an artist. He's a carver. And I kind of love this idea of his, and I'm borrowing it here. He doesn't think that the question of whether something is art or not is a valid question. He says, is this thing working as intended? Does it add beauty to this space? Does this cheese taste good and pair well with wine? You know, like he was talking about, like the art of cheese making or the art of soapstone carving or something like that. The art is like an act, not an end product. And so for me as a commercial artist, like, does what I'm doing draw the right kind of attention to this idea, to this brand or this story? Does it produce positive feelings? Those are my intended functions. And then, so this is my back, trying to get back to your question. If you want to restate it again, then I'll kind of take it home.
Sorry. It's basically like, can design be art, and can art be design?
Right. So that question almost feels like, I know what you mean, but it almost feels like a not important question to me.
I know. I could be stating it wrong. It's something that I've heard ever since I was in college. When I was in high school, I took graphic arts classes. And so I feel like in that environment, my teacher taught us that, you know, art and design were something that can be one and the same, or could be completely separated. When I got to college, I had professors who said that art and design are completely separate, and they can never come together. And I've always been in the camp that of like what I first learned, which was that art and design, they can be separate, but they can also come together. And I think a great example of that is poster art, right? Poster art is a sense both art and design at the same time.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I'm probably overcomplicating it, just because I think about this kind of stuff a lot, and sometimes I get in the weeds. But I mean, you get that. That is like the design school question. Like, is design art, right? And but that's only looking. Imagine you're in a school and there's an art department and a design department, a design program and an art program, because one is more self-expression and very self-referential within its own world. That being art. And the other one is about serving clients' needs and you know, making logos and branding programs or think in context of like websites, making them totally usable and stuff like that. You're thinking about the user, and then you'll have purists on either side, right? You'll have the purists who say that there's no room for artistic expression in design. You know, you go in and you make the thing work and you get out of the way, you stand back. But there's an undeniable level of art in design. It's part of the tradition. It's part of the dialogue, design's beginnings. The idea of design as being a thing even has its roots in art. Like I'm very cloudy on my art and design history, but art and design histories are in a sense parallel and often the same, and then at a certain point they seem to sort of diverge.
Yeah.
But I just think it really depends on who you are and what you want. There are design studios that are clearly making art.
Yeah.
You know, I think about, say, Tad Carpenter, who mm-hmm. is a designer, but he makes beautiful posters. And
oh, yeah.
And there's nothing but art in that. But I guess illustration
mm-hmm.
is designed art.
Yeah, I agree, right? 100%. Yeah.
And so maybe the mediator between the art and design world is illustration, because it's taking art that would be in a vacuum or kind of untethered to any purpose other than sort of an self-expression kind of thing, and it's saying this art has a purpose, but it's using design to do that. It's using the principles of design. It's using the sense that of an audience, the awareness of an audience and all that. So
I know, right? This is like a very deep question. It's like, it's something where, you know, it just happened to pop up. I could have swore that I wrote it in my questions, and then I realized I removed it, and I was like, it might be good to just hear his thoughts
yeah.
on that.
No, it's a great question. Yeah. And so in that sense, yeah, I didn't think it's an important question. And I hope by that I meant, like, if we're trying to figure out, like, what exactly is art or whatever, like, just do like design or illustration the way like that you're most inspired to do. And I think there's room for all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, you're going to have purists on either side. And I often think people who are too puritanical about their stance on a question like this, like whether mm-hmm. art and design are the same or not, I feel like you can't, that's dangerous to get too black and white about that. You're gonna like
yeah.
really dig yourself into a corner and not learn anything new or something like that.
Completely agree. So let's go back to Skillshare, right? Because as you said, like, you have the title of top teacher, which I didn't even know there were titles like that until I was looking at your page the other night. I didn't even realize they had something like that. First off, congrats. That's an amazing thing to see. Why did you decide to start creating the course? I mean, you kind of touched on this a little earlier ago, but why did you decide to start creating them and becoming a teacher in the process?
Well, it was around 2015. I actually just got contacted by Skillshare about doing a class. And after a bit of back and forth, I was kind of sold on the idea, and I was off to the races. Mm-hmm. At first, I never really thought I thought I'd just try it, see how it goes. I didn't think it would become such a big part of what I do and part of my kind of outward facing identity. But when I made that class, I put in the time and effort to make as good of a class as I could, to make it as unique and original and useful to people as possible. Once I made it, I saw how students were interacting with it, that they were really learning and enjoying it. And I love seeing them make projects based on these things that I was teaching. It was like these people all around the world. And it just, yeah. it was like, wow, that is really neat. And so I was totally sold. I love the engagement and having that audience. And really on Instagram and on YouTube and on Skillshare, they're all the same audience for me. It's all fellow illustrators on any part of the journey, but a lot of them are like students, people I'm trying to like share knowledge and insights with, stuff that I wish I knew or stuff that I think will help them. So I really love that.
Yeah. And I'm curious, like, was it difficult to like start that first course or even any of the courses moving forward?
All courses I've ever made are hard. Anything creative that I do is very hard. You can ask my wife. I disappear while I make things because I'm an overthinker and I just need, I do that. Ask like, I'm working on a class right now and I've been emailing back and forth and sharing Google Docs with the folks at Skillshare and getting their input. And you can ask them, like, I've probably sent like 5 or 6 different revisions of my class to them. Like, oh wait, no, I've changed. And the short answer to your question is it takes a lot of work. Yeah.
So when does the new course come out?
This one is I'm hoping I can get it recorded and produced within the next month, at least in time for the Christmas break or New Year's. That's the peak time on Skillshare. That's when most people have the time. They have a gift subscription that they got in their stocking or whatever. And so that's for me, I try to launch late October or early November. I've already missed that because I'm overthinking this one. But yeah, that's when I...
Can you give us any little teaser as to what it's about?
Absolutely. I was going to save this for later when you ask if there's something I wanted to share what I'm currently working on.
You can share it here now and then. Either or.
So it's basically about editorial illustration. And what I found while I'm researching this topic, there are a lot of classes that handle it, but none really show students how to do it themselves in their own unique way. It's sort of like watch me work. And they're great classes, and they're by people who are far more qualified to be teaching editorial illustration than me. When I look through my own work, I actually don't have a lot of like big editorial illustrations. A lot of my editorial work are these smaller moments called spot illustrations.
Yep.
And when I look at the kind of clients that I have the most of, it's that. So my specialty is spot illustrations. And this is a great kind of test lab or microcosm for people to develop very specific concept-based illustration skills in. So I wish this answer was a lot shorter, but here we are. I'm still talking.
You're totally fine.
My class is going to be about answering the two fundamental questions that plague every new illustrator. How do I come up with my ideas, and how do I know what style I should work in? And so the class is going to walk students through a series of exercises to help build their conceptual and stylistic skills, including how to make sets of images that express ideas with personality that also stylistically relate as a set, full stop.
I love that. I think even though like I've been doing illustration for years, I am definitely going to take that course because, and here's the thing is a lot of people are there like when they hear that I take Skillshare courses, they're like, but you're already an illustrator. You're already a designer. That doesn't mean anything, you know, because other people do things differently. And if absolutely. I can pull just like one, I always use the term nugget of wisdom from one of your courses that can impact the way I work in other projects, then it's perfect. I'm fine, you know, sitting down for a couple of hours watching a course because of that one little thing. And, you know, like for instance, I'm doing your Inky Maps course right now. Yeah. And I've done maps. I've done two maps before, but I've already learned. And just like watching the first few, I haven't even gotten really started doing too much, but in the first few videos, I already learned, holy crap, I never had a compass rose in my maps. I never had, you know, a lot of labels. I think one of them might have followed that, but the other one didn't have like a ton of, you know, direct labels or like elements. So just like in those first few videos, I already learned, you know, more than I knew before. Right. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I still take Skillshare classes too. I don't do the projects usually, but I drop in. And I audit the class, and I usually watch all of it or listen to it while I'm working. And I mean, one class that I've gained a ton from was Martina Flores' Golden Secrets of Lettering class, because that's something I'm not particularly, that's not my corner. And so to just see how it's done, it really helps make my own lettering a little bit that much more nuanced and differentiated from maybe people who don't know a lot about what goes into letters and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, my favorite is Draplin. I love watching his, and I still remember I watched one of his typography social courses, and I just like instantly started playing with things. And next thing I knew, I created something for an actual client based on what I learned from his Skillshare course.
Nice.
So you never know what you're going to pick up or what you're going to see. Sometimes there are things that you already know that you don't, that you're like, okay, I knew that. Perfect. But then there are things where you got that like aha moment, you know, that spark, and you're like, holy crap, why didn't I do this before?
Exactly.
So one last thing on that. What's your favorite course that you've done?
Definitely Odd Bodies.
Odd Bodies?
Yeah. So Odd Bodies is a class where I teach how to draw or illustrate stylized, expressive people. And it comes really from the fact that, like, in my own work, for a long time, I avoided drawing people because it's easy to get drawing a person wrong, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so, like, you might as well just get at expressing an idea just through, say, illustrating objects or using type or something, just avoid drawing people. But somehow along the way, I just found a way of doing it in a more intuitive and expressive way. And people were noticing, like, I you know, and you catch vibes of what work of yours is resonating. So yeah. Like, oh, well, I'm not like an anatomically correct illustrator. I can if I try and I practice, but that's really not what I want to do in my commercial work. And so this is what I can bring. I can teach people how to sort of, in a way, systematize the process of drawing people not realistically. Mm-hmm. And what turns out, I'm learning through the testimonials, that a lot of people can only draw realistically, and they really struggle to illustrate people in a style, and so it's surprisingly hard for people who can draw really realistically, really easily, to draw it simply and in a very stylized way. And a lot of people, for this is like a game changer. So
yeah, for me, I'm the opposite. It's so hard for me to do realistic. Like, I've done a few realistic drawings, but I've always been more simple, cartoony and everything. But even me, like, I'm always working on projects that involve creating characters. And every time I go to start creating a character, I have this anxiety or this fear that it's going to turn out, you know, bad, or it's going to turn out crappy. Mm-hmm. And so it's not until I actually get started on it, I start doing it, that I finally build up that courage or momentum in order to actually do it and everything. And for me, it's always hands and feet are always the hardest for me to get that.
Oh, absolutely. And in my class, I call hands and feet are part of a list of body parts that I call pain points.
Oh yeah.
In illustrating people. So yeah, but totally, a lot of it is just getting started. And once you get like those key parts of the person down, you fill in the rest, and then you're good. Like, it's just that getting started and fearing, how is this going to turn out? And if you can actually promise yourself it doesn't have to turn out great or like anything you thought it would, mm-hmm. before you started, then you'll have more fun doing it. And yeah, so that's really like what the class has been about. And it's been really fun seeing people's, so this was a risky class for me to produce, because a lot of Skillshare classes are kind of around an hour or less,
yeah,
and based around a very concrete single project. But this one was, I believe it was 6 exercises that you do that are each one kind of approach drawing people in this way in different ways. And I thought, who's going to want to spend all that time? And then I just tacked on what I call a bonus project, where you can take one of those and turn it into a full illustration.
Yeah.
I'm just going to cough here. And I'm now done coughing. I'll just announce every next thing I'm about to do. So the fact that people are going through all these, and not only doing that, but they're like writing long posts on the project pages, mm-hmm. about their whole process, which is insane to me. Like, in my mind, people just want to like get in, get the skill, do the thing, get out. But these people are I say these people, my students are like laboring over these projects and really thinking about it. And that's very satisfying as a teacher, to see people really taking the content to heart and working through it.
Yeah, that's such a spectacular thing, right? I put out a self-published course a while back on just like learning like the basics of like drawing a face. Mm-hmm. And I'll get people who have bought the course, or, and I, here's one thing that I do is like, if people, I tell people, listen, like, if you know someone that would love to benefit from this course, just pass it on to them. They don't have to pay for it. Just pass it on.
Nice.
Because I believe so much in just like the sharing of knowledge. And so I've had people who contact me who've bought it, or who have gotten it from other people, and they tell me about how they love to do it, how they, you know, used it or implemented it into their own process, or how they changed things and made them a little bit different, you know, to fit their style or fit the way that they do things. And it's so beneficial to see that.
Oh, totally. Totally. It's addictive.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's you, sometimes you have to be careful because right, there is that little bit of ego that plays into it. Right. And you have to be like, okay, don't let my head get too big, you know, bring it down, bring it. You're still that same guy in San Diego or that same guy in, you know, British Columbia and everything. So it's like, you kind of have to try and stay grounded. But I'm curious, who or where have you pulled inspiration for your work? You know, your ever evolving illustration style, as you've put it in the past.
Yeah, my roots are always, like, I always go back to my love for all things mid-century, vintage. Mm-hmm. So the Provinsons, Saul Bass, Ben Shawn, Miroslav Sasek, Paul Rand as a designer, Alex Steinweiss. Yeah, I mean, I could keep listing a lot of those influences, but I've always been interested in old stuff, like ephemera, not posters or anything like of real import, but actually like just like packages or match boxes, things from that just somehow feel very nostalgic to me, like old Christmas decoration packages, like an old box of tinsel or something from 1978. I find all that stuff really fascinating and neat, and I think it's the simplicity and directness of a lot of that work, and a lot of those things were made to fit the technologies that were available to reproduce them at the time. So you have single or double two colors to work with, and you don't have like gradients or even dots, like halftone dots to work with. It's all solids, and so that vintage look is something that I've always tried to like work from. And I love the constraints of them. I love like these people did so much or so little. They didn't have computers. They had an X-Acto knife and
some Ruby lift.
Some stuff that even though I know kind of in principle how it works, I still am like, how did they do that?
Yeah. I still remember in college, I had a professor. He had been out of the industry for over 20 years when I took his course. And he would talk about how, like, this is how we used to do things. And it's crazy to think back about when you look at those old pieces of packaging, right? And you look at them, you're like, how in the world did they go about creating these things? You know, they didn't have, you know, Macs or Adobe software and things like that. They were going through and they were actually hand cutting them out of Ruby Lip, or they were hand drawing them onto sheets of I don't even remember the names of it, to like transport onto offset presses and everything. So it's really interesting to see that. I actually just started a Pinterest board where I just started collecting all that stuff, you know, anything from I actually have an entire section just for match books. Yeah. I have one for beer cans. I have one for travel stickers. Cool. That was something that people always used to do, is they would have every single hotel that you would stay at would have travel stickers for people to slap them onto their, you know, steamer trunks and everything, so that everyone knew where you came from, where you stayed. And that was their little bit of advertisement even before there were billboards and everything.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I just love that stuff. So I'm still to this day as inspired by that stuff as I am, although my work is less referencing it than it used to be. But at its core, I love how you can take like a solid color and then a squiggly line or a line or an outline and bring those things together to create an illustration. And it's just that impact of that one color and that one line quality. And that's very much evident in my first Skillshare class, Inky Illustrations. And then today I've definitely like become more comfortable being a little bit more dimensional in the amount of tools and techniques that I use. But I always go back to the simplicity of that, the principle of these built-in limitations that allow you to actually be more creative. So,
yeah. So I actually have, I put out a call yesterday. I only had a couple people respond, but I put out a call for questions for you. And there was one that really stuck out that I thought it kind of goes with what we've been talking about here. And that is, you know, this comes from Adam, who follows me on Instagram. What's your process for finding fresh ideas for illustrations for both personal or for client work?
Okay, yeah. When you're a freelance illustrator or even a designer, you're always being presented with new creative problems, new subjects, new contexts. So ideas kind of come from the problems I'm mm-hmm. trying to solve. So there's the first thing is like, there's always that external stimulus from the client. And then for me to get out of kind of my paradigms or the unoriginal ideas and stuff like that, to try and find ways of expressing something meaningful in my client work, I rely on a process that involves a series of steps that sort of just trick me into bigger ideas than I would have thought right away. So mm-hmm. I have it's actually kind of boring to describe, but like it's how I come up with my ideas. Like I have like these named parts of my process, like research and discovery and mm-hmm. iterative rapid sketching that over time kind of becomes refined and solidified. So those two things is like, I have a deep dive where I get my head into a topic and I look for what interests me about that topic. So the first step is finding out as much as I can about just this other world that I don't know a lot about. I don't have to be an expert. I just have to know a little bit about it, more about it than I did before. But then I have to find out what I'm interested in about. That's very important mm-hmm. because suddenly there's a point of view. And then when I get into sketching actual ideas, I have a process of just sort of what I'll call rapid sketching or rapid prototyping. You just throw stuff up over and over and over again, then take a break, you come back to it, you see it with new eyes, and then you pick a few that stand out, and then you iterate on those more, you refine them, and you solidify them. So there's no such thing as an idea for mm-hmm. me. It is only a process. And you make decisions along the way based on what you see. And the ideas emerge sort of as a secondhand product, if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense to me, especially because, and this is, I'm loving the synergy that we're having between like, nice. You know, our backgrounds and style, because that's one thing that I do. I'm a very process-driven illustrator and designer. And I've seen in the past from a lot of illustrators, they don't really have, like, they might have a process, big mm-hmm. process, air quotes, and it's just, they don't actually do a lot of research and discovery. They don't really look into the industry. They basically are just handed a creative brief. They sketch out a bunch of ideas. A client picks yeah. one. Then they go in, they start ideating on that, and they're just doing ideations after ideations after ideations. And then mm-hmm. finally the client's like, okay, I'm happy. You know, yep. versus, yeah, it's right. It's like, that's the thing that you hear. And that's what people perceive when they work with illustrators. Is they think that that's what they're going to get. And
Oh man. Yeah. You've got me. Started. Yeah.
I mean, it's something where it's like, and maybe it's because I wonder if it could be based on your background too. But mm-hmm. for me, it comes from the fact that I was, you know, a branding designer. I was a UI UX designer, especially when I was a UI UX designer. We really had to focus on strategy and learning as much as we could about the client. And I think it was my time doing that really helped to change my process and to influence that to where it is today, where I'm asking so many more questions. I'm forcing my clients to actually fill out an information page where I'm asking, you know, okay, we have a hero illustration. What is the title of this illustration? What's the description? What is it supposed to be doing? What ideas mm-hmm. do you have for mm-hmm. that? And I'm making them fill all this out. And sometimes the clients are like, why am I filling this out? And I'm like, trust me, just mm-hmm. watch how quick this process goes if you just take the time to fill it out. Absolutely. And it just helps out tremendously.
There's a lot to be said about meeting halfway with a client. That mm-hmm. they're not just sending you away to do the creative work. Because if they do that, you're going to come back, show them something they were never expecting, and it's 50-50 yep. chance that they'll send you back to the drawing board. Whereas, if you include them in the creative process in ways that they can actually contribute, like your job as the illustrator is to be the creative. But that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be included. So including them with lots of questions at the briefing stage is huge because suddenly they're thinking about things they would never have thought about before. They're asking questions that they didn't know about to ask before. And it's in that process that will both improve the quality of what you make for them. Mm-hmm. So they'll be more satisfied and greatly improve your process, streamline it. You'll be going back to the drawing board a lot less. And yeah definitely.
Yeah, and my favorite analogy, and I probably have said this on the podcast before, but my favorite analogy is, you know, when clients are asking, you know, why am I giving you ideas, is that, okay, let's say you come to me and you want me to draw a dog, all right? What you picture as a dog is different than what I picture as a dog. You could be mm-hmm. thinking Great Dane. I'm thinking Chihuahua.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
So it's like there's so many different things. What's in my head is going to be different than what's in your head. And mm-hmm. since the whole idea here is to figure out the way that we can work together where we can have that synergy with the client and make sure that we can figure things out a lot quicker, be more agile. And this, like you said, it involves them in the process. So they become mm-hmm. way more invested.
Exactly. Into it.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. Once they're invested, once they've put something into it, they're going to be less likely to tear it apart because it's theirs too.
Exactly. Yeah. They helped along this way. And if all of a sudden, like, I've had clients where they pivot, where they all the way leading up, you know, halfway through the project, we're like, okay, we're going in this direction. And then all of a sudden they're like, actually, we decided we want something different. It's like, well, this was what we started with. Like, this is the North Star. This is like what we've been leading to. And if we pivot, then that's just going to throw all of that hard work out the window mm-hmm. and everything. Sometimes it helps to keep us on the same path. And sometimes you have to pivot. But mm-hmm. at least we have this as like a backbone for the project.
Totally.
So in a lot of cases, and this is still going on illustration, but in a lot of cases, illustrators will work in specific like industries or categories. I am an illustrator working primarily with, you know, web and mobile, right? Mm-hmm. You've worked in so many different types of illustration design projects in the past, including editorial, packaging, commercial, etc. Do you find it hard to break into these different categories or industries?
I've found it natural to do work in this range of work. Mm-hmm. My design background, I think, has probably made that more likely. Yeah, I feel like a lot of them have just come to me and I've said yes. Like I haven't pigeonholed myself. Whatever that sounded like, I did mean. I haven't pigeonholed myself. I've tried to balance an openness to doing new things with also having a personal vision and trying to refine and create a very specific voice. And along the way, I guess I've tried my hand at a lot of things and I haven't been afraid to try these different mediums. They're all interesting to me and I'm very comfortable just going in and figuring out how to do it, whether it's doing a map for a huge wall in an office mm-hmm. or, you know, designing a greeting card that's actually a tin that holds hot chocolate in it. Like there's lots of things that I've worked on that are kind of out there and it's fun just to do it all.
Yeah, I think there's this like envy between some creatives, whether you're a designer or an illustrator, and I even have it too, right? It's where, you know, you see people working on certain projects and you're like, oh, I would love to work on a gig poster for my favorite band, or oh, I would love to, you know, create some sort of illustration for packaging or a mural for an office space and everything like that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the biggest problem that people have. And I know I have this problem too, is figuring out how to get those projects or how to, you know, break into that space.
Yeah. Well, the important thing is for me, I would love to do like a Warby Parker mural. I had gotten contacted by their agency of record a few years ago to do that. And mm-hmm. then it fell off the mat. Like it somehow just, they went quiet on me. So I guess they found someone else, but it's kind of put a bug in me. I was like, I want to do that. I want to like do a space for a retail and in like a really fun, like whimsical style and get bold with shapes and colors and stuff like that. Like I know I want to do that. And so far the exact thing that I want to do hasn't happened yet, but along the way, other things that are like it are, and I'm doing them. I'm saying yes to them. Like case in point, there's a map that I did of Vancouver and it's in this really cool boardroom mm-hmm. on their wall. And I did another one for like a real estate developer company in Vancouver and it's in their showroom. And so it's like, those are really cool, I still want it to be more high visibility, big brand. You know, I want to do something on the. I want to be invited to do a wall in Facebook or something like that.
Yeah, or Target or something.
Yeah, that'd be really cool. But meanwhile, I'm because I'm tuned in, and I know I want to do more big surfaces like that. I'm saying yes to more of those projects that I might be like, well, this is going to be a lot of time to do, and I have these other kinds of work. It's basically. It allows me to say this project, no matter what, is going to be worth my time because it's part of a goal that I have.
I like that. I like that. Yeah. Like that. I think that's one thing for me is like in the past, I always wanted to do editorial illustration. And the thing that finally told me that maybe I shouldn't do it was the cost, right? Editorial. That's one thing that a lot of people don't know, or they don't talk about, or they find out almost when it's too late, that editorial illustration doesn't actually pay as much as doing illustration for a website.
Exactly.
And for me, that was like one of the hardest decisions because I always wanted, my dream was to one day be, and this is so specific for me, is to be, to create an illustration for Men's Health. Mm-hmm. I love Men's Health magazine. I love the illustrations that they'll have in their issues and everything. And I wanted to be able to create an illustration for one of their issues. That was that's like a bucket list project for me.
Yeah.
But then I started finding out how much an editorial illustrator actually gets paid versus also how much time they're given for an illustration. Alexa, stop.
That's awesome.
You had your cough.
I've never seen someone be interrupted by Alexa before.
I get it all the time. It's either Alexa or Siri back there will do it. Because I have a HomePod back there too. And both of them will interrupt me. But that whole idea of the cost versus the time, right? Because so, like, let's say in an example, and I could be completely off on the figures here, but let's say they want like a quarter page illustration or spot illustration like what you do. Mm-hmm. And their budget is, you know, $500 and they need it by, it's Friday and they need it by Monday.
Yeah.
Right.
Low budget, fast turnaround.
Exactly.
Yeah. That is editorial in a nutshell. And it is, I do editorial. I fill it in between my bigger jobs because they're fun, fast and fun, but only on my terms. And if it's it's Friday and they need it by Monday, no way. I'm like, unless it's the New York Times. Because it's the New York Times and that's on my bucket list and I haven't done it yet. So there's some ones you just have to bite the bullet and do it. But I wouldn't do that for a long time. There'd be a point where I'm like, I'm not doing that anymore, no matter who you are. So.
Yeah. Well, let me actually ask you now that just prompted a question from me. With those quick turnaround editorial projects, do they give you complete freedom or are they like art directing you like crazy?
Well, first of all, I rarely take on an editorial project that doesn't give me a couple weeks to work on it.
Oh, okay.
I just filter most projects that expect me to put out anything in a week because I work slow and I don't want to. I don't want pressure to work fast.
Yeah.
And I've been able to do that even when I actually wasn't doing financially awesome as an illustrator. I still said no to those kinds of projects because it's not a habit I wanted to be in.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I have a very regimented process that. I rely on to make sure ideas are sold before I get too far down. And it's like the client can buy in at the sketches stage and know exactly, aside from like the color and magic that happens in a finished illustration, they know exactly that the concept works and I don't pivot from that in the final. Mm-hmm. So it's funny. It's like most of the time I'm lucky enough to nail the creative concept and just move forward with no revisions in editorial.
Mm-hmm.
But there are just certain kinds of publications that I know it's going to be different. And it's ones that I think know me as an illustrator, perhaps they're a Canadian publication and they just like, here's a Canadian illustrator, let's use him. But they don't really know what to expect from what I'll give them. Maybe they think that I'll do it in a style that's more different than mine or something. Mm-hmm. And then there's a bit more of like a process of just getting them on board with who I am as an illustrator and then moving forward. And those are more annoying. And I've tried to learn the art of avoiding those kinds of projects, those kinds of clients, I should say.
Yeah, I'll the one thing with me, and I'm curious your thoughts on this, is for me, I work in a range of different styles, and I can be very versatile. You know, if a client comes to me like, hey, could you create something in this style or that style? You know, I'll take a look at it and I'll, you know, judge, okay, is this something that'll be quick, easy, or is this something that would be way too difficult for me to attempt to do? And then I'll decide, you know, if I'm going to do it. But do you work specifically in your style and that's it? Or do you push the limits or, you know, agree to work that isn't using your style or isn't planning on using your style?
One of the first things I do when I get a client request from a new client is I make sure I know who they think I am and what I do through various questions that I ask. So if they don't show me themselves, I'll ask them, can you please just go to my portfolio or to my Instagram and just pull examples of work that you got inspired by and what made you come to me? And that immediately gets them, if they hadn't thought about it, they're going to think about it, but chances are they have thought about it. And once they do, I know what I'm doing because the worst thing for me is if they show me someone else's illustration. We want something like this. I'll say, no, thank you. I don't want to work with someone who has any assumption or like they think they had an idea in their mind of what they wanted that wasn't anything that I would make or want to make, or I wouldn't want to imitate a style, you know. I used to have to do that a little bit more, but I've just gotten to a point where and I've worked hard for this. It's not like I don't want to say this as someone who feels entitled. I feel like I've worked very hard to get to a point where I can say, like, this is what I work in. This is my range. And I'm happy to sort of flex it, especially for advertising. I often have to kind of, they pay a lot more, so I can be a lot more flexible. But yeah, I've tried very hard to make it clear that I work in this specific style. And that just helps the process go so much more smoothly. And whenever I've tried not to do that, the project's been very choppy and I haven't enjoyed it. And the client's not been very pleased with the work, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I've had certain situations. Luckily, a lot of my clients, they find me through my work. So it's like that's how they come about contacting me. So it's not like I have to be like, you know, are you sure that you're contacting the right person? But I do get some of these instances where people come to me like, hey, can you create illustrations like these? And it's like the most horrible 3D looking illustrations or characters. And I'm like, have you seen my work? Like,
Yeah,
this is not
exactly.
how I work.
Yeah.
So I'm actually curious about this too. A lot of creatives, they find themselves experiencing, you know, burnout or hitting a brick wall while they're working on projects. How do you deal with that, or have you dealt with that, and how do you go about combating that? Does that make sense?
Totally. No, I've heard you talk about this in your podcast. One of your episodes, I think you talked like only about that. And like for instance, like I agree that getting away from work for a bit helps. And for me, I run most days, and that gives me something outside of work to focus on and work towards. So like I set up a race in the future. This is only very recent for me, but like now, like I'll set up a race and a goal, and then I have a plan and I work toward it. And just having that, just work is, I mean, working out and getting your heart rate up and using your body helps you think fresh, right? And getting burnt out sometimes is just spending too much time on one kind of thing. And so having just a multifaceted life helps. If you're in the middle of a project and you have and you're finding that burnout within the project, I think you just have to be stubborn and work through the frustration as best as you can. If you had to do this over and again, you will burn out and then you have to change something. I have one major antidote for both creative block and burnout, and that's I come back to this a lot. I've already come back to this a lot in our conversation today, is my rigorous, reliable creative process. And so that includes specific steps wherein I focus on one kind of creative task at a time, right? So I'm not spread thin in any one moment. So the second thing is I have known conditions in my process that will be conducive to creative problem solving. So I set up those conditions. I limit, and then here's a big thing, and I think you talked about this, I think in this in your episode about burnout, where you sent 50 iterations of a logo to your client. and they weren't, they're like, nope, 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 nope. Is that, do I have that right?
Yeah, that was when I the first time I ever experienced burnout in my career, when I was working at this branding agency in Savannah, Georgia. And I basically, like, I had clients that were every single week, we were just sending anywhere from 50. I feel like there's one time where we almost went through 100 logos in a week, and just were sending them out to a client. And they were just like, nope, nope, nope. And I'm like, what do I do then? Mm-hmm. And it just completely, and I wasn't prepared for it because I had never heard anyone ever mention burnout before.
Yeah. Well, that's a recipe for burnout. That exactly. Yeah. And that's actually what drove me into freelancing and doing things my way, because I had an idea of how I could solve that. Mm-hmm. And the biggest thing is you limit the amount of options that you show to a client. It's not that you don't make thousands of ideas by yourself, but you don't show those thousand ideas to a client, because you are giving them anxiety by having to choose, because they're not the creative people. You are. You're the one who should be able to steer the ship, the creative ship, and recommend what works best. Not say, it's not a box of chocolates where they should pick one, the flavor they like. It's like, you came to me for my specific recipe for solving problems, and now I'm going to solve it. This is like a famous Paul Rand quote. Paul Rand said to Steve Jobs while he was helping him brand something. And
I think it was Next. I think
yeah, it was Next. Yeah. It was Next. And so, you know the story. Jobs is like, so when can I see some options? And Rand's like, options? No, I'm going to solve the problem and you're going to pay me. And that Rand was a rock star. So I'm not going to go around saying that to people, but that is my overall approach. And it's both to keep creative projects, the quality of them, the result and the process on track, and to not go insane as a creative person, is you don't show a lot of options. You don't open that door. You show a few, just enough to give people a sense of inclusion in the process and decision making. So that's a huge way for me that I've avoided burnout, is just controlling the process in a way that sets me up as an empowered guide to the creative process, and not giving so much, opening the door for my esteemed clients to kind of start wearing hats, or expect that they should be wearing hats that aren't theirs to wear.
I found since all of that, like, I think also part of it is the more experience you have, the more you're able to deal with like burnout or creative block. And I do agree, like, I love that quote, that Paul Rand quote and everything. I think that the one thing that I've noticed is that, you know, back then when I worked it was in Focus Lab in Savannah. When I worked there, we were very big on just like getting a lot of stuff in front of the client and trying to like see what stuck, right?
Yeah.
And I think now when I look at like branding projects or even illustration projects also, I'm very intentional about everything. The process, I do agree. I love that what you just said about how process helps prevent this. And I think it's, you know, when you're very intentional about what you're doing, you create, you still might create a bunch of options and everything, but when you just show like the one, maybe two options, and you know, it's a lot more direct and you can get a lot more direct feedback from a client. You can get an approval very fast and everything. I recently took a webinar with a retro supply company with one of the founders of Forefathers, Amir. I can never pronounce his last name, so I'm not even going to try and butcher it. But he actually revealed in his process that they actually don't do revisions. Okay. They don't do revisions. They don't show a ton of options. They go from sketching out an idea, sharing with the client, getting the buy-in right then and there. Like, this is the idea that we want to move forward with. And then they go and create that. And they might share some things. And if a client has a couple little tweaks here and there, that's fine. But they don't go through and do like three rounds of revisions, like I've heard so many other times from other studios.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I try to get as much buy-in in the sketch phase. So I'm very front heavy in my process. And so I spend a lot of time coming up with ideas or trying to solve the problem through sketching. And then I'll show three tops, like maximum three options per illustration, for instance. Yeah. And And I tell I communicate to my clients that like if you want to work out anything to do with composition, concept, or content, we're going to do it in the pencils.
Yeah.
Because it's easier to move things around and change and get it right there than in the final. I include, just for the sake of the perception of value, 3 rounds of revisions in my final art. But if it's anything that is different from what was sketched, that's a new illustration, I'm going to get paid all over again. Yeah. And they know that. So I guess it's kind of like what the Retro Supply workshop might have taught you. It's sort of like I want to give some leeway because I might make a mistake. I might get something wrong, might put a color in there that they hate or something like that. And, you know, you have to give them a few bones, throw a few bones and be flexible and adaptable and willing to be wrong. But it's sort of like you have your chance in the sketch to get that right. Once we're here, once that's a contract, and once that's signed and approved, mm-hmm. if you change that, then we're yeah, just minor revisions in the final.
Yeah, I do something very similar where in sketching, like I don't have a set of revisions because that's where it's very important. That's where we're trying to get all of these things figured out and done. My revisions are in like when we start vectorizing, you know, when we bring it into Illustrator and everything. And, you know, it's actually interesting because what I do is my sketches is all about composition. It's making sure that everything, you know, works, that there's some things that we're going to change,
totally.
You know, maybe that's going to happen in styling and everything. Mm-hmm. And I do everything in grayscale before I share everything with the client in grayscale. I never show in color because of the fact that they focus so much on color versus the actual composition.
You're right. Yeah. Yeah. The more high resolution something is that you show them early on, the more they're going to give you comments that are they're not the right comments at the right time. You want a client commenting on concept, composition, and content at first. You want them to say, yes, the stuff that you've included in this image are working for our purpose, but you don't want them commenting on whether there's a drop shadow or you know, a texture or the reds too orange. Like those don't matter at that stage, and that's part of keeping the project on track and not burning out. Mm-hmm. And like I said, one of my things, I need to have specific steps where I focus on one kind of creative task. I don't want to think about color at the sketches because I'm not there yet. And one of my least favorite requirements when I'm working with clients or big projects is when they ask me to do color roughs. I'm like, color figures itself out later, not yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's always the most interesting part because I've had clients that are like, why are we looking at in grayscale? Let's look at it in color. I'm like, no. We need to figure this out now because mm-hmm. otherwise, if we don't figure it out in grayscale, we're just going to be running down a rabbit hole. And I learned that very quickly when I was doing freelance in, I want to say college, or maybe it was after I moved out to California, that I would have clients that they were focusing way too much, being so nitpicky on just color. Well, this yellow is not working for me. Let's actually switch it with green. And we'd be almost to the finish line. And then they'd be like, you know what? We actually don't want this person to be holding, you know, a drink. We want them to be holding an iPhone. And it's like, this is stuff that we should have talked about way early on.
Exactly.
And everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're almost at the tail end. I know we've been talking for over an hour, almost an hour and a half. I do apologize that it's gone this long.
No, I'm enjoying the conversation. I'm almost afraid that I'm it's my fault somehow.
Oh no. See, that's the thing is I'm a talker too. So it's like, and you know, I imagine you probably spend a ton of time in your studio and not interacting with other people. That's how I am. I'm in the mm-hmm. studio space Absolutely. All the time. And it's rare I get to go out. So when I do get to have one of these conversations, it goes long. And I think people usually don't have a problem with that because they love to just hear about all this, the process and everything.
Yeah, no, like I'm on board.
So what are your 3 favorite projects that you've worked on throughout your career?
Okay, that's a hard question probably for all of your guests, but
okay. Well, how about this? How about we shorten that time frame, right? How about we say in the last 2 years? The last two years.
Okay, I did write a list out so I could be thoughtful about it. But okay, so my current project has become one of my favorite projects. It's mm-hmm. still in the works. I'm illustrating a kid's book about castles right now. Ooh. I've been working on this since January. I completed the entire book in July, and then they had a direction change. And they went from a sort of informational book to a kid's picture book. So I'm basically re-illustrating the whole thing. And at first I was so deflated. I was like so excited to get the job out the door. I know this is a long answer, but...
No, you're fine. It can be a long answer. It doesn't have to be a quick short answer. It's fine.
As you can see, I'm very self-conscious about being a rambler. But I'm going to just dig in here. And anyway, so I was really deflated. I was like, I became an illustrator so I could ship projects, fast. It's like these year-long design projects that I would get very... antsy in. But anyway, I'm actually as I'm now starting to work on the final illustrations for this book, they're coming together in such a fresh way that couldn't have happened if I think my first illustrations were really labored and overworked, and now that I know exactly what my moves are and my steps are, I'm taking them very confidently in the work, and I'm very excited about that. So that's one of my favorite projects.
You know, that's actually interesting what you just said, because you ever had the moment when you're working on something in Illustrator or Photoshop or whichever program you're using, and then all of a sudden it crashes? And mm-hmm. now, I don't know about you, sometimes I forget to hit save, mm-hmm. and now it's gone forever. And you basically have to go back in and recreate it, mm-hmm. or sometimes even change it up. And that second time around goes by so much quicker. It's so much more insightful, and it ends up being even better than the original. Have you ever had that experience?
It happens all the time, and sometimes I actually do that on purpose. I look at a work the next day, and I'm like, I'm doing this again. Yeah. But I know I know the steps to take, and so it is a lot faster, and the end result is a lot fresher, because those little corners that I overworked, or the texture that I kept going over and over and over, I want to move on, so I'm faster in the second one, and it's actually somehow more magical. There's something more magic about it. Totally.
Yeah. Okay.
A little hot tip, though.
Oh, okay.
If your Photoshop or Illustrator is about to crash, you haven't saved it, you know it's happening, you know it's about to crash, you see the little beach ball, screen grab that, and just get it on your, do a quick screen grab. And it's at least something you can work from.
I like that. I like that tip. That's actually perfect.
The other thing is I just use Time Machine, and it usually has something something before that. But I guess the you do have to save it. So
yeah, I mean, there work. Are some times where Illustrator will pull something up and everything. Like, even if you never save the document, sometimes it will pull it up. It
recovers it, yeah.
Yeah, and luckily there are those instances where it does it, and it might just be 5 minutes have passed. And you hope, okay, hopefully this 5 minutes wasn't a ton of work, and then now all that ton of work is gone.
Yeah, we did that perfect stroke and it's lost.
Yeah.
So my other two favorites, if you're talking just broadly projects, Odd Bodies is one of my favorite, mm-hmm. Illustration-related projects. And I don't know exactly how it's going to turn out, but recently I did a whole bunch of illustrations that are going to be three-dimensional installations at Incheon Airport in South Korea.
Oh, really?
So they have the whole the mall part of the airport, the duty-free shops and stuff like that. Yeah. It's called Air Star Avenue. And so, for the holidays, it's going to be my illustrations, but 3D. I don't even know what it's gonna look like, but I'm really excited about it. So
I hope that you get high quality photos of it,
Yeah, I definitely hope so too. They've done photos for previous projects that they've done for this airport, so mm-hmm. I have no doubt they'll do that also. Otherwise I might have to take a trip to Seoul.
Yeah. Hey, well, there you go. That's a fun way of getting out. Oh, yeah, I have to go out and photograph something I created.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's something that I always ask all my guests. I'm trying to, every time I do another interview, I try and push the envelope with some of the questions. But this is something that I always ask the people who come on, because I feel like it's very important to a lot of the creatives who are students or they're just trying to break into the creative world. For those people, what are three pieces of advice that you have for them? Like, it could be three pieces of advice that you wish you would have known when you started off, or just like things that you think that would relate to them.
Okay, so three pieces of advice for people who are trying to break into illustration would be, first, if you love it, that's your permission to pursue it. Don't feel like you somehow have to meet some kind of qualifications or criteria to start learning illustration or even call yourself an illustrator or an artist. You know, like, do whatever. If you love it, you have permission to pursue it. You know, there's no barriers. The second thing is, if you want to succeed, you must be obsessed enough to study it and put in the effort. Yeah. I think a lot of people like illustration, but they don't geek out enough. Like, they should find out who's doing the kind of work you love, where it is, who's making it. Are they writing books? Are they doing interviews? Do they have a YouTube channel? Follow them on Instagram. Mm-hmm. Go deep, and not just with like the people now, but people who, you know, more historical, who are like, for me, like, really learning about Paul Rand has changed my whole perspective. Like, I have a few of his books, and his thoughts on design have really influenced my thoughts on the creative process and design. And just, really, I mean, that's just one example. Like, when I first got into design, when I first was inspired that this thing was a thing, I went and bought books. I went to the library. I go to galleries. I needed to consume that. I think that's one part of it. And then that obsession has to carry over in your work ethic, trying things, failing, being vulnerable, taking classes, all those things. You have to do that. You have to put in the effort. So
exactly.
That's my second one. My third is, don't make excuses. Make your own opportunities now.
I love that. I don't know if you've like read any of my blogs. You've heard some of the podcast episodes and things like that. I am a huge believer in creating your own opportunities. Mm-hmm. And whether it's side projects or something, I've started using self-initiated projects where you have a specific type of client that you're wanting to bring in, but you don't have that coming in. So you just start creating stuff for that. I think that that's a huge thing, that doesn't matter where you are, like what mm-hmm. kind of design or illustration that you want to do. It's super important to create those opportunities for yourself, just to even have the practice or to allow people to see your capabilities. Mm-hmm. I sat down, I went to this pop-up crop con here in San Diego this past weekend, and there was someone I was chatting with, and she was telling me how she has these clients coming into her, and she wants to, I believe she wanted to do some sort of beauty, like packaging or branding design, but every single time they kept telling her that she just didn't have the experience or didn't have the work in her portfolio. Mm-hmm. And I suggested to her, you know, instead of just like letting those rejections come in, use that. If you don't have that in your portfolio and you're constantly seeing that same rejection, you know, just create some of it, you know, just mm-hmm. start doing it. If a client came to you and they gave you a creative brief, but you didn't get the project, use that creative brief in order to create a project similar to that.
Yeah, 100%. So part of it is creating those work that proves you can do what you want to do. There's also taking on jobs that maybe are below your aspirations, mm-hmm. not being too good for them, because those are the ones you have right now. And your job is to make those the best you can, to transform those from some, you know, maybe it's like a word mark for your mom's friend's mitten business. I don't know.
Yeah.
Example, but
no, it's not stupid at all, actually. Cause like I've had a lot of people, they tell me they're like, you know, like I'm working at Staples or I'm working at Office Max or some sort of like place. And mm-hmm. they're like, but I want to be doing like full-time work at a studio or agency, or I want to be doing freelance work. And I say to them, I'm like, well, just working at this job is not going to stop you. You know, you can still do that. You can still build your portfolio. You can still do work and still freelance while you're going there, and never be ashamed of having, you know, that job. When when I was in college, I worked at Office Max. When I graduated, I almost got a job working at some, I can't remember what store it was. I think it was like Walmart or Target, you know, just so I could at least have some income coming in while I was trying to find one of those jobs. There's nothing wrong with stuff like that.
No, not at all. Not at all. You know, you do what you have to do what you want. And and you just, along the way, look for those opportunities that are presenting themselves right in your face. And you might think that they're not good enough, but that's what you have. Yeah, I had this thing, like, especially when I was in computer engineering college and I was trying to, I really was anxious to get into design and just get in there. I knew that it was either I could just dream about it or I could make it happen. And it's like, I kind of had this saying, it doesn't really make sense to say it out loud, but I would say if then when, or it was just like instead of saying if I'll do this only when this happens. Yeah, it totally doesn't make sense to say out loud, but it's like,
I know what you're saying there.
I will only do this thing. Like, for instance, I really want to take pictures and get into photography. I have to wait until I get, only when I get like money to buy an expensive camera and get the gear, will I be able to take the pictures. But I'm like, no, I'm going to just take this 1 megapixel camera that I found and take pictures with this right now. And it's like, just use what you have and build on it.
Yeah, I'd love that. I think, and that also goes into, I love that thing where you're like, you know, if you just have a 1 megapixel camera and everything, you know, just do that. You know, you don't have to have the most expensive things. You don't have to have the most new things in order to, you know, create things, right? I've always been, you know, I'm an Apple addict. I buy all the new Apple things. I've got the new Apple AirPod Pros in my ears right now and things like that. But I do that because I can afford to do that, right? And I have people, they come to me, they're like, hey, like, I want to get the new iPad Pro, but I don't think I can afford it. You know, is there something else out there that I can do? And I try to help them. Even if I don't know, I'll try and actually look it up and find what there is. Or if there's people saying like, hey, I really want to use like Adobe Fresco or something like that. And I tell them, well, you might actually have to get, you know, the new iPad Pro. And I try and think of ways that they can go about either like earning some money real quick to do it, or, you know, how they might be able to finance it and everything.
Whatever it is, like, don't rely on this unachievable thing. Don't let that get in your way. Get there somehow.
Exactly.
Right? Set up a lemonade stand. Do whatever you have to do. You know, it is that sort of pull up your bootstraps mentality. I'm kind of built in with that, and so it works for me. I know that's not, there's all kinds of complications and difficulties that people have, but as much as you have within your power, look for the excuses you're making that aren't actually problems. They're things you can actually solve through steps and do those.
Yeah, I agree completely. Sometime in college, my Wacom tablet crapped out. I had no money to buy a new one and I was freaking out. And so what I ended up doing was I created a Kickstarter. I had a bunch of prints I had done for one of my clients and they said, hey, go ahead. You can use these. You know, we know that you're trying to get money to get this new tablet. And I did. And I was able to, in a couple of weeks, raise enough money. I stopped the Kickstarter as soon as I got the money that I needed. And I think like a week or two later after it cleared, I was able to buy my new tablet.
Nice.
So it's like, you can always find ways of doing it. And sometimes, you know, it just is like, hey, asking a friend or asking someone, hey, can I, you know, borrow some money to do this? Or can I pay you back with like an illustration or a logo or something like that? You never know what it could be. I don't know how we got off onto that tangent.
Yeah, well, I think we're just talking about making our own opportunities and doing whatever it takes to get the things we need to make our goals happen.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So we're at basically the end of this. You know, besides, I know you mentioned the new course that's coming out hopefully before the end of the year. But is there anything else that you want to give like a shout out to or anything like that?
Well, the course right now is something I would love to have people have top of mind, just to know that if you're trying to work out how to come up with ideas and find a style to work in for, say, editorial illustration, mm-hmm. that's what this class is going to be about. And it's going to be coming out hopefully before the end of 2019. And if not, then, you know, very soon after. And that's it. Otherwise, like, I guess I could just let people know where they can find what I'm working on. And you were probably going to ask that anyway.
That was actually the next part of it. But like where can everybody find your work?
Yeah, sure. Instagram's kind of my little laboratory where I post whatever's happening now. And that's at Mr. Tom Froese. And my website is tomfroese.com. That's just where I keep my kind of polished collection of work. And then I have a YouTube channel, as I mentioned before, where I love to answer questions that you guys have about illustration. And I also occasionally will just post my thoughts, insights, and inspiration on illustration. And of course, you can find me on Skillshare.
Yeah, and all of those are going to be linked in the show notes. I have one quick little question. I meant to ask it earlier. Did you create something for Liberty Station here in San Diego?
I don't remember. The name doesn't ring a bell.
Okay, it would be in Point Loma, I think. And the reason why I asked that is because I've been there twice now in the last like couple of months, and every time I'm driving in, I see some sort of banner or poster or something, and it is unequivocally your style. And I'm like, did he create something for that?
Is it just like, what's the context?
I can barely remember it. I just know that somebody was carrying, I think, American flag or something like that. I can't remember. I'll have to, next time I go there, I'll have to take a picture of it and send it to you.
Yeah, please do. take a picture. I've had people send me pictures of work asking me if it's mine. I'm like,
oh, yeah.
Nope. I've done the same too. Like, I'll see something on like a website and I'll send it to an illustrator and be like, is this yours? I'm like, no. And then I'm like, I don't know. Somehow I feel like I've insulted them because it's not their work, but it's also interesting just to see what people think looks like mine. And please send it my way.
Well, thank you so much for being on here. Literally, we just hit the 1 hour and 40 minute mark.
Yes, we did.
This is probably, I think this is going to be the longest podcast that we have right now.
I'm not going to lie that I get this feedback from most podcast interviews I'm on. So hopefully that just means that we have a good conversation.
Oh yeah. No, like I had a blast, you know, and everything. So no, this was perfect. But yeah, so definitely I'll make sure that everything's in the show notes. And when your new course comes out, I'll make sure to share it on my newsletter so that everybody can see it.
All right, everybody, thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Design Break Podcast, and I want to do another big shout-out to my friend Tom Froese for sitting down with me and letting me talk his ear off and him talk my ear off for almost an hour and 40 minutes. That is amazing. I think it is the longest episode that we have so far, and it is probably one of my favorites that I've done this year. I'm really excited for 2020. This is the first episode that's going to be going out this year, and I can't wait to see what new episodes come out in the future. Now, the next episode that we're going to be doing is actually going to be a very special one. This episode is going to be featuring my beautiful wife, Vanilli Rourke, and she's going to be sitting down with me and basically letting me interview her on questions that all of you have talked about or asked me in the past. If you guys have any questions you would like me to ask her during this interview, please send me a DM on Twitter or Instagram at Rocky Rourke, and I'll be sure to add your questions to the list. I have no idea what's going to happen with this interview, if it's going to be just a complete roast of me, or if it's going to be, you know, heartfelt and, you know, warming. I have no idea. It's really exciting and scary at the same time. We're going to be recording this episode probably in the next couple of weeks, but I'm really excited for this. Also, if you haven't already, please remember to rate and review the podcast wherever it is that you guys listen to this podcast, whether it's on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, wherever it is, please remember to write and review the podcast. It's always great to see new reviews coming in, new ratings, and it really helps push me forward with this podcast. As always, if any of you have questions, whether it's about the things that I'm discussing in the episodes, or if it's just general questions you might have about freelancing, illustration, design, please feel free to reach out to me on Instagram and Twitter. I try and answer my DMs every once in a while. There's so many of them that it's sometimes hard to get through them all at once. So I do apologize if you guys have asked any and I haven't had a chance to get to them. But please feel free to reach out to me. I'm always an open book and I'm always able to help you guys out. So that's it for today's episode. Please remember to always stay passionate, stay positive, and stay creative. Have a great day, everybody, and create something new today.